Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. I need to kind of keep it calm. I need to kind of not get too animated. I've got a sick girl, my baby, my English bulldog. So I've mentioned this before. She kind of, you know, dogs will attach to one of somebody in the family, and this one attached to me. And so she goes through anxiety attacks when I'm not around. But anyway, she's not feeling good, and so she demands to be with me so that I know how bad she's not feeling. So anyway, we'll see how it goes, see if I get any interruptions, and we'll take it from there. But we do have a lot of content to get into, and just so you know, we have 26 more citations. I went ahead and counted because I realized, wow, this is a long, and I knew there was a lot of meat to Virginia, but that's just how much meat there is in getting into the discussions of the militia regarding jurisdiction and so forth. This is gold. I mean, this is a treasure chest of facts and empirical data right here in this one ratification debates, or this one state's ratification debates. So anyway, as you know, the show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. And you are still listening to the only show. And I don't know why, but this will be the only show that will actually assert the solutions. Now, not because it's a copyrighted thing. I'm more than happy to let anybody talk about Republic Review. It's just not that Republic Review is not to become a money-making endeavor. The framers did not make their declaration an industry so that they made money, because had they done that, then they would never have secured liberty for America. That's why I constantly tell people that we have to put aside our self-interest as well as our differences. And that self-interest is all about, you know, these guys trying to make, you know, their money, whether they're writing books of killing something or something killing or whatever. There's all sorts of conservative entertainers out there that are making great money, and they're very smart. They articulate very well, but they're not offering you the tangible solution. They're not standing up and saying, if we do this, most all of our problems will go away. And it's that simple. That's what Republic Review is. So again, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org as well as ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. And we will be getting into, you know, after a few shows, it looks like we may take the rest of the week just to get through Virginia. But we will be getting into a few of the interviews that we've had and so forth. And if you look at the Red State Talk Radio podcast page on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org website, that's where you'll find, you know, some upcoming interviews and so forth. So we're trying to keep that up to date so that you can kind of see the topics and some of the things that we're going to be giving you as far as content. And some of these dialogues, some of these interviews are very powerful. They're very insightful. Anyway, with that, what I want to do is just dive into... let me see here. This is George Nicholas, right? That's right. Mr. Nicholas is getting up, and he's responding to George Mason. And this is what he says. Mr. Chairman, I feel apprehensions lest the subject of our debates should be misunderstood. Everyone wishes to know the true meaning of the system, but I fear those who hear us will think we were capaciously quibbling on words. We have been told in the course of this business that the government will operate like a screw. Give me leave to say that the exertion of the opposition are like that instrument. They catch at everything and they take it into their vortex. The worthy member says that this government is defective because it comes from the people. Its greatest recommendation with me is putting the power in the hands of the people. he disapproves of it because he does not say in what particular instances the militia shall be called out to execute the laws. This is a power of the Constitution, and particular instances must be defined by the legislature. But, says the worthy member, those laws which have been read are arguments against the Constitution because they show the states are now in possession of the power and competent to its execution, or competent, I guess that's what it is, competent. Yeah, I've never used that word before, but competent to its execution. And yet it means capable or knowledgeable to its execution. Would you leave this power in the states and by that means deprive the general government of a power which will be necessary for its existence? If the state governments find this power necessary, ought not the general government to have a similar power? But, sir, there is no check in the business. The gentleman near me has shown that this is a very important check. Another worthy member says there is no power in the states to quell an insurrection of slaves. Have they it now? If they have, does the Constitution take it away? If it does, it must be one of the three clauses which have been mentioned by the worthy member, which is executing the laws of the Union, stopping insurrections, or stopping invasions. The first clause gives the general government power to call them when necessary. Does this take it away from the states? No, but it gives additional security, for besides the power in the state governments to use their own militia, it will be the duty of the general government to aid them with the strength of the Union when called for. No part of this Constitution can show that this power is taken away. But an argument is drawn from that clause which says that no state shall engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. What does this prohibition amount to? It must be a war with a foreign enemy that the states are prohibited from making. For the exception to the restriction proves it. The restriction includes only offensive hostilities, as they are at liberty to engage in war when invaded or in an imminent danger. They are therefore not restrained from quelling domestic insurrections, which are totally different from making war with a foreign power. But the great thing to be dreaded is that during an insurrection, the militia will be called out from the state. This is his kind of argument. Is it possible that at such a time the general government would order the militia to be called? It is a groundless objection to work on gentlemen's apprehensions within these walls. As to the fourth article, it was introduced wholly for the particular aid of the states. A republican form of government is guaranteed and protection is secured against invasion and domestic violence on application. Is not this a guard as strong as possible? Does it not exclude the unnecessary interference of Congress in business of this sort? The gentleman over the way cannot tell who will be the militia in a future day. And he's talked about George Mason again. And enumerates dangers of a select militia. Let me attend to the nature of gentlemen's objections. One objects because there will be select militia. Another objects that there will be no select militia, and yet both oppose it on the contradictory principles. If you deny the general government the power of calling out the militia, there must be a recurrence to a standing army. If you're really jealous of your liberties, confide in Congress. And so Mr. Mason then gets up, because of course, you know, he's George Nicholas has been, you know, kind of pounding away on his arguments. And this is what he says. And he says that he was totally misunderstood. The contrast between his friend's objection and his was improper. His friend had mentioned the propriety of having select militia like those of Great Britain, who would be more thoroughly exercised than the militia at large could possibly be. But he himself had not spoken of a select militia, but of the exemption of the highest classes of people from militia service, which would justify apprehensions of severe and ignominious punishments. Mr. Nicholas then responded in kind and said he wished to know whether the representatives of the people would consent to such exemptions. Every man who had 25 acres of land could vote for a federal representative. So now you actually see what it took for you to participate in a federal vote. You had to have 25 acres of land back then. Now they've expanded. You don't even have to own land. You don't even have to make money anymore to be able to vote. You don't even have to have any skin in the game, as Obama called it. You could just, out there voting for whomever is going to give you something that they unconstitutionally can't do. Now, the best way to fix that problem with people, voting for people that are giving away handouts, as far as I'm concerned, the best way to solve that problem is by going out and actually, taking these people that are making these promises and then putting into law unconstitutional government that creates entitlements such as health care, such as welfare, education, those types of things, taking them out, arresting them, and taking them out of public service and trying them for treason against the Constitution, because clearly those are not enumerated powers. Anyway, we're at a hard break, so we will be right back after these two promos. So please stay tuned, and we will have George Mason on exclusivity coming up. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue. Okay, so I can't tell you how many times I've actually bantered back and forth and argued with individuals regarding the exclusive legislation that is in the Constitution. As a matter of fact, you'll find that in Article 1, Section 8, and if I remember correctly, you'll actually find that is, I think it's subsection 17. Let me double check. Yes, 17, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, and then in parentheses, identify some clarifying of the district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by secession of particular states and the acceptance, become the seat of government of the United States and exercise like authority over all places. So in other words, they're just saying that they have exclusive legislation over that district. Somehow, we've become stupefied to believe that those words mean that the exclusive legislation is everywhere, that the federal government can exclusively create an act and it becomes the law of the land. No. When they create an act, most acts, unless it becomes an amendment, only applies to the seat of government, to District Columbia. Now, I've never seen an amendment where Congress no longer has this exclusive legislative authority. In other words, they still have it. The fact that there is a Congress, or I should say a mayor, and the fact that they get representation now, and the fact that they're trying to make the district a state, no. They're not partakers of the republic. This is the seat of government for which they are to occupy, to do the work and provide the services, security services, you know, fight our wars, maintain foreign affairs, and that's it. So anyway, there have been people like Ralph Epperson that I've argued with on the air. There's other people, and I don't want to say that I've argued, but you know, we just don't agree on this one principle. And I've proven and I've provided these insights, and this happens to be one of them. And this actually happens to be George Mason. Now, who's George Mason? George Mason is the Anti-Federalist. Now, why am I reading the Anti-Federalist over this issue? Because as an Anti-Federalist, even he concedes that their legislation is limited to within that district. Now, I'm going to read it now. But Mr. Mason gets up and says that there were a few clauses in the Constitution so dangerous as that which gave Congress exclusive power of legislation within 10 miles square. Implication, he observed, was capable of extension and would probably be extended to augment the congressional powers. But there's nothing in the Constitution that's ever done that. And he says, but here there was no need for implication. This clause gave them unlimited authority in every possible case within that district. So you get that? There's the key words right there. Unlimited authority in every possible case within that district, and only within the district. Nothing, they cannot legislate willy-nilly for the states at all. This has been argued, and here he is actually stating that within this district, they have this full authority. He's nowhere is he saying that they have this authority per the Constitution over all the states. He just points out within that district. This 10-mile square may set a defiance of the laws surrounding states. In other words, let's just say that all the states finally make drugs or alcohol illegal again. We do prohibition, and all drugs, all alcohol and everything is illegal. Well, Congress could actually make alcohol legal within the District of Columbia just for themselves, because they have exclusive legislation for that district. The only thing that would apply to Congress is if, you know, or I should say, if Congress legislated something, the only way it would apply to the states would be if it was through an amendment. And that is pure and simple. And he says, this 10-mile square may set at defiance the laws of the surrounding states and may, like the custom of superstitious days of our ancestors, become the sanctuary of the blackest crimes. Here the federal courts are to sit. We have heard a good deal said of justice, and then he goes on about the trial by jury and so forth and so on. But the case of the matter is, and the fact of the matter is that this here is Mason, as an Anti-Federalist, identifying that they do have this limitation to within the district. In other words, they're unlimited, but they cannot go outside the district with that unlimited power. So just to be clear. And then Madison pipes up, and this is what he says. Mr. Chairman, I did conceive, sir, that the clause under consideration was one of those parts which would speak its own praise. It is hardly necessary to say anything concerning it. Strike it out of the system, and let me ask whether there would not be much larger scope for those dangers. I cannot comprehend that the power legislating over a small district which cannot exceed 10 miles square and may not be more than 1 mile, or may not be less than 1 mile, will involve the dangers which he apprehends. If there be any knowledge in my mind of the nature of man, I should think that it would be the last thing that would enter into the minds of any man to grant exclusive advantages in a very circumscribed district to the prejudices of the community at large. We make supposition and afterwards deduce conclusions from them as if they were established axioms. But, after all, bring home this question to ourselves. Is it probable that the members from Georgia, New Hampshire, and etc. will concur to sacrifice the privileges of their friends? I believe that whatever state may become the seat of the general government, it will become the object of jealousy and envy of the other states. Let me remark, if not already remarked, that there must be a cession by particular states of the District of Congress. So in other words, this is the one chunk of land that has a very specific purpose that's not for anything but governing the Republic. So just to be clear, all the other things within Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17 that are listed, you know, are very specifically listed because, as I read it before, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by cession of particular states and acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature, in which the same shall be for the erection. So in other words, when the federal government buys land from the states, and they legitimately are buying land for them to possess, here is the list of the things that they can purchase that land and possess it for. And it goes on by saying, for the erection of forts, in other words, military-type bases, magazines, military storages of munitions and such, and arsenals, dockyards, in other words, you know, ships, ports, and so forth, and other needful buildings, in other words, like a general accounting office, or let's say you want to have an embassy. There's an embassy, I think, in Los Angeles to do the work of creating passports and providing, you know, interface for immigrants and so forth. I mean, so we have a few embassies throughout the United States that are a part of the State Department for needful purposes, but they can't. They cannot. Nowhere does it mention anything for forestry? Does it mention anything for agriculture, for environmental purposes, or for locking people into a lot of land so that becomes their reservation? They don't have the power to possess any land. They have to buy it from the state once that state becomes a state, and they can only possess it for these reasons. Now, as long as it's a territory, they do have exclusive use or exclusive legislation over a territory as well. But once that territory transitions into a state, all property within that state becomes that state and whoever owns the property. So if you have a deed within that state, then your deed becomes a part of the state holdings. But it's not state property, it's your property because you have the deed for it. But all the rest of the land that there's no deeds for, the state owns. So, I just want to be very clear here that what Mason was admitting to was he was admitting to the fact that the federal government was limited to the District of Columbia. And so, anyway, Madison goes on and says, let me remark, if not already remarked, that there must be a cession by particular states to of the District of Congress, and that the states may settle the terms of the cession. The states may make what stipulation they please in it, and if they apprehend any danger, they may refuse it altogether. How could the general government be guarded from the undue influence of a particular state's or from insults without such exclusive power? And then he goes on. There's another good little chunk of reading to do, so we'll finish this. What Madison has to say regarding exclusive powers when we come back. But this is something you really have to understand, because lots of people hang their hat on this fact that the federal government has all these, you know, full exclusive legislation for everything. And that is a outright lie. We'll be right back after this.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
And so here's the beautiful thing about Madison. I mean, Madison does a brilliant job of giving a lot of good information. I kind of appreciate Mr. Nicholas. I appreciate Mr. Iredell. Some of these guys can kind of get down right down to the nitty-gritty and kind of put it out there in just a few words. But Madison goes on and he continues and says, if it were at the pleasure of a particular state to control the session and deliberations of Congress, would they be secure from insults? Would Congress be secure from insults or the influence of such a state? If this Commonwealth depended for the freedom of deliberation on the laws of any other state, where it might be necessary to sit, would it not be liable to attacks of that nature? So they were just basically creating autonomy for this general government to sit outside of the controls of any other state, to have full autonomy and full legislative power over that piece of land. Anybody, I'm telling you, anybody who tells you otherwise, that the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, right there, that exclusive legislative power means that they have all this power over us, they do not understand, nor have they read these explanations as the Constitution was being sold, quote unquote, to the states. This is so important because how he defines this right here and how this, even Mason's admitting, yes, that we, they only have exclusive power within that district. So to be clear, they cannot just make a law and it becomes law of the land. Now, I hate to say this, the Equal Rights Act, the ADA, a lot of laws that the federal government has made is really, it's only applicable to the District of Columbia. No state is compelled and is forced to abide by those things. And as a matter of fact, those acts and laws have become wedges for the state to do very nefarious things in playing games, as in trying to provide social justice, which, as I have said in my promos, social justice is the redistribution of wealth and outcomes. It is tantamount to communism. Well, that's, you know, and I've actually heard very similar words come from the Supreme Court. You guys have had, you know, your run for as long as it is, and now we're going to control the game. You know what? Two wrongs never made a right. And as a matter of fact, just because guys were doing the wrong thing with the court, because they were, Taney was wrong with his Dred Scott decision, same thing with Plessy v. Ferguson, a lot of rulings were absolutely wrong. So what do? Well, we can't fix the past. The only thing we can do to fix the past, if this is really what'll shut you up, is you can dig these people up and burn them in effigy. Maybe that's the only thing that, you know, might actually shut these people up. But I mean, what we have to do is we have to point out just how ridiculous, just how childish these people are being, because we have and have had a perfect system. This has been perfect. I mean, the framers said, well, you know, there may be some defects to this. Yeah, maybe some. But as far as all governments that exist on the face of the earth, this is as perfect as they could be. Anyway, Madison goes on and says, would it not, he's basically talking about the cession of the seat of government, would it not be liable to attacks of that nature and with more indignity, which have already been offered to Congress? With respect to the government of Holland, I believe the States General have no jurisdiction over Hague, but I have heard that mentioned as a circumstance which gave undue influence to Holland over the rest. We must limit our apprehensions to certain degrees of probability. The evils which they urge must result from these clauses are extremely improbable, nay, almost impossible, and I'll even go to say they are impossible. They're impossible. As we understand it, they have to amend the Constitution to be able to extend themselves beyond anything. They have to be granted that power, and it defies any logic. It's not within the contract. It's out of context. So, anyway, we're going to move on to the next thing that Madison says after Grayson, then Nicholas, Grayson, then Lee, then Henry, and then Madison gets up and basically says this. Mr. Chairman, I'm astonished that the honorable member should launch out in such strong descriptions without any occasion. Were there ever a legislature in existence that held their sessions at a place where they were not, where they had no jurisdiction? I do not mean such a legislature as they have in Holland, for it deserves not the name. Their powers are such as Congress have now, which we find not reducible to practice. If you be satisfied with the shadow and form instead of substance, you will render them dependent on the local authority, which is the way it is now, at that point in time with the Continental Congress. Suppose the legislature of this country should sit in Richmond while the exclusive jurisdiction of the place was in some particular county. Would this country think he says county, and then he said, would this country think it's safe that the general good should be subject to the paramount authority of some part of the community? The honorable member asks, why ask for this power if the subsequent clause not to be fully competent for the same purpose? If so, what new terrors can arise from this particular clause? It is only superfluity if that latitude of construction, which he contends for, were to take place with respect to the sweeping clause. Now, what is the sweeping clause? The necessary and proper clause. There would be room for those horrors. Or this, the necessary and proper clause is at the very end, and it's right there at the very end of 17, which basically says all these foregoing powers, that Congress shall have the power to do whatever is necessary and proper to put into action these foregoing powers and only those foregoing powers. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. And he goes on, this is what Madison says, there would be room for those horrors, but it gives no supplementary power. It only enables them to execute the delegated powers. If the delegation of their powers be safe, no possible inconvenience can arise from this clause. It is almost but explanatory. It is almost but explanatory. Yeah, that's what he says. For when any power is given, the delegation necessary involves authority to make laws to execute it. Were it possible to delineate on paper all those particular cases and circumstances in which legislature by the general legislature would be necessary and leave the states to all their powers, I imagine no gentleman would object to it. But this is not within the limits of human capacity. The particular powers which are found necessary to be given are the foregoing delegated general and particular and minute specification is left to the legislature. And then the scribe makes this little note. At this point, Madison's speech became so low they really couldn't hear anything. And then what they heard last of him to say was, when the honorable member objects to giving the general government jurisdiction over the place of their session, in other words, where they're meeting, does he mean that it should be under the control of a particular state that might, at a critical moment, seize it? I should have thought that this clause would have met with the most cordial approbation, as the consent of the state in which it may be must be obtained, and as it may stipulate the terms of the grant. Should they violate the particular stipulations, it would be an usurpation, so that if the members of Congress were to be guided by the laws of their country, none of those dangers could arise. In other words, kind of making it its own little teeny state. But it was clear that this little session of land was not to be represented. It was the land of representing the states. The fact is that we've come full circle to where they're trying to make Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, a state. The 51st state is repugnant to how this was defined by James Madison right here. Because bottom line is, this is where the states come together for their representation to work together in executing the laws that are pursuant with the Constitution. And so, you know, it's just hard for me to fathom that we've got so perverted. But that's exactly what happens when you get into this. Now, the next person that speaks, because Mr. Henry gets up and pokes Madison real quick, and then Mr. Pendleton then gets up and says, Mr. Chairman, this clause does not give Congress power to impede the operations of any part of the Constitution or to make any regulation that may affect the interests of the citizens of the Union at large, but it gives them power over the local police of the place so as to be secured from any interruptions in their proceedings. Notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe, sir, this is the fair construction of the clause. It gives them power of the exclusive legislation in any case within that district. There's those powerful words again. Within the district. Oh, well, we're at another break. And so When we come back, we're going to be going through Mr. Pendleton's focus on exclusivity of Congress within the District of Columbia and how it is limited to that district, period. So we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
Are you a patriotic proprietor of a business that is looking to get exposure on a fast-growing program? How would you like to get exposure on the only program on the air that provides an actual constitutional solution to all the federal government overreach and encroachments? If you understand the importance of educating the electorate, we would love to work with you in growing your business and revenues while you support the airing of our content on this station. Your support goes to growing the reach of this show and does not pay for elaborate salaries or highfalutin lifestyles. The show is growing fast, and we're also planning on airing the content about Republic Review on a video medium soon. If you'd like to be a part of history and the growth of the most relevant and result-oriented show on the air anywhere in the world, then just email me at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can lock in exceptional pricing and great advertising opportunities. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so Mr. Pendleton, will probably wrap up with this one because after this, it's George Mason, and he has a few things he wants to harangue about. But anyway, this encompasses both the militia and the exclusivity clause. And so, Mr. Chairman, this clause does not give power to Congress to impede the operation of any part of the Constitution. I mean, that right there says a mouthful. Or to make any regulation, they may affect the interest of the citizens of the Union at large. Another critical part. I mean, anybody that is going to tell you that this exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia means the Union at large, point them to Pendleton right here. I mean, Pendleton, you know, he hits it out of the park. I think this is one of the most highlights that Pendleton brings to the table. I mean, this is the big one that he brings to the table. But it gives them power over the local police of the place so as to be secured from any interruption in their proceedings. Notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe, sir, this is the fair construction of the clause. It gives them power of exclusive legislation in any case within that district. Those powerful words again. What is the meaning of this? What is it opposed to? Is it opposed to the general powers of the federal legislature or to those of the state legislatures? I understand it as opposed to the legislative power of that state where it shall be. What then is the power? It is that Congress shall exclusively legislate there in order to serve the police of the place and their own personal independence. They may not be overawed, which means what, intimidated or scared or what have you, overawed or insulted, and of course to preserve them in opposition to any attempt by the state where it shall be. This is the fair construction. can we suppose that in order to effect these salutary ends, Congress will make it an asylum for villains and the vilest characters from all parts of the world? Well, okay, that's what's happened today. I mean, because they've gotten so far outside the boundaries of the Constitution. Will it not degrade their own dignity to make it a sanctuary of villains? I hope that no man there will ever compose that Congress will associate with such prolific characters. Now, I will tell you that when I was in the Pentagon, working in the Pentagon during Reagan's era in administration, I used to walk around the streets of D.C. because I was a night guy. I worked in the Pentagon at nighttime, mid shifts, right? I got there at 6, left at 6 in the morning, so 12-hour days. And so if you're up all night when you're not working, then you kind of screw yourself up if you adjust to the daytime. So anyway, when I was not working, I would walk around the streets with expensive camera gear in my hands and around my neck and so forth, taking pictures of DC, 35 millimeter and so forth. And I'm telling you that the paradigm or the mores of that town, the attitude, it changed dramatically after Reagan, then Bush, because by the time Clinton got in, shootings, it just started getting rampant and crime started increasing. The moral debasing from social engineering just started catching up with us. And I don't know if it's just all about Clinton. I don't think so. But I do know it's all about the debasing and social engineering that had made D.C. become, one of the richest places of opulence, but also a haven for crime. Anyway, why oppose this power? Suppose it was contrary to the sense of their constituents to grant exclusive privileges to citizens residing within that place. The effect would be directly in opposition to what he says. It could have no operation without the limits of that district. Were Congress, you understand what he just said? It could have no operation without the limits of that district. In other words, they can't operate outside that district's limits. Were Congress to make a law granting them an exclusive privilege of trading to the East Indies, it could not have no effect the moment it would go without that place, for their exclusive power is confined to that district. I don't get it. I don't understand why people not reading this, they need to read the ratification debates if you want to understand the Constitution. That's how people have made all the wrong deductions on what this says in the Constitution, what the Constitution says, or how people have interpreted it, from Marshall and the Supreme Court to as well as some of these people that I would consider, like Ralph Epperson. I think he's a pretty conservative guy. I think he's a brilliant historian. He's a brilliant man. He's just got this all wrong. He has to read the ratification debates if he wants to be right on what the Constitution says. Anyway, Pendleton goes on, were they to pass such a law, it would be nugatory and every member of the community at large could trade to the East Indies as well as to the citizens of that district. This exclusive power is limited to that place solely for their own preservation, which all gentlemen allow to be necessary. I mean, you get it now? Anyway, will you pardon me when I observe that their construction of the preceding clause does not appear to be a natural or warranted by the words? They say that the state governments have no power at all over the militia. The power of the general government to provide for arming and organizing the militia is to introduce a uniform system of discipline to pervade the United States of America. But the power of governing the militia, so far as it is in Congress, extends only to those such parts as they may be employed in the service of the United States. When not in the service, Congress has no power to govern them. The states then have the sole government of them. Now, one of the things that was important that the federal government be arming and, creating a uniform standard I believe everybody in the militia should be issued whatever those guns, and so that the ammo and everything else would all be interchangeable. Right now, if you've got militias in all these independent states, because there is no regulating of the militia by as far as the arming, training, and those things coming from the federal government, that's why we are in a disarray. They have deliberately made this mess out of the militia and out of our Constitution so that they could rely on a standing army unconstitutionally. And though Congress may provide for arming them and prescribe the mode of discipline, yet the states have the authority of training them according to the uniform disciplines prescribed by Congress. But there is nothing to preclude them from arming and disciplining them should Congress neglect to do it. Well, now that becomes expensive, right? But if you use it as your police force, your 911 force, your, you know, first responders. I mean, if your militia becomes your fire department, your police, and your nursing, ambulance, and all that type of stuff, then, okay, now you've got full, you know, you've just transitioned a lot of people into, you know, the county control as well as then state control, and you start standardizing these things. Does that make sense? Anyway, as to calling the militia to execute the laws of the Union, I think it fair. I think the fair construction is directly opposite to what the honorable member says. The fourth section of the fourth article contains nothing to warrant the supposition that the states cannot call them forth to suppress domestic insurrections. Here, and then he reads this, and Pendleton reads this, are all the restraints here contained in that Congress at their pleasure on application of the states or invocation of the executive protect each state against domestic violence. This is a restraint on the general government not to interpose. The state is in full possession of the power of using its own militia to protect itself against domestic violence. The whole petitioning part of Article 4, Section 4, by the way, this is GR editorializing, that whole part is if you need more support because the invasion is overwhelming your militia, the executive or your state legislatures should be able to either engage Congress or the president to say, we need immediate help. Get some other states in here. That was the whole purpose here. And the power in the general government cannot be exercised or interposed without the application of the state itself. This appears to me to be the obvious and fair construction with respect to the necessity of the 10-mile square being superseded by the subsequent clause, which gives them the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department thereof. I understand that clause as to not going a single step beyond the delegated powers. What can it act upon? Some power given by this Constitution. If they should about to pass a law in consequence of this clause, they must pursue some delegated powers, but they cannot by means depart from them or arrogate any new powers, for the plain language of the clause is to give them power to pass laws in order to give effect of the delegated powers. So I think Mr. Pendleton does a really good job in explaining all of this, and I hope this really helps. I hope this really helps you understand, you know, how we can shut down all of these arguments and how the academic evidence is overwhelming. The federal government is so far outside its bounds. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.